This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, ask language where it thinks it's going dressed like that. This is the last show of the first year of The Allusionist. Thanks a lot for joining me on the learning curve. If this is your first Allusionist, welcome. Now, go off and listen to some of the other episodes before returning to this one, because this one is deviating from the normal form, and I wouldn't want your data to be inaccurate. Today's show will feature a smattering of anecdotes that there wasn't room for in the episodes before, and I'll be tackling a few of the requests you've sent in over the year for word histories, such as this one from John Mark in Oxford. I was wondering whether you'd be willing to take on some meta-etymology in your podcast and shed some light on the etymology of etymology. As you wish, John Mark. Not to be confused with entomology, the study of insects. Etymology is from ancient Greek, etymon, which meant true or real, and logia, which meant study. So it's the study of the true sense of a word, which is at odds with a lot of etymological theories, which are bollocks. Such as, is it an acronym? No, it's almost certainly not an acronym, especially if it's a pre-20th century word. That's just not how words were formed. Or, does this seemingly innocuous commonplace word have horrible racist etymology? Usually, it's not the innocuous commonplace words which have the horrible racist etymologies, but people do really seem to want to believe the worst. And here's an example from Matt, who says, I've heard simply horrible origins for the word picnic, which I hope aren't true. If what you've heard, Matt, is the widespread assertion that picnic derived from people having a nice snack whilst watching African Americans get lynched, it's not true at all. Of the word, at least. Apparently that situation was all too real. But the word picnic was not associated with it. It arrived in English in the 18th century from the French word pique-nique, which originally referred to people bringing their own wine to restaurants, and the word eventually gathered the ideas of everyone bringing something to the meal and eating it outside, but not serving it with a side dish of hate crime. There's already a lot of terribleness in the world, you don't need to invent more. But nonsense often has more traction than the truth, and particularly when a word's origins are obscure, false etymologies sprout in the linguistic shadows. And sometimes the false etymology is so fun I want to believe it, even though I don't, as in this request from Gav for the origin of the term you're fired as it relates to employment. One ambitious suggestion is that in the early 20th century, John H. Patterson, the founder of the National Cash Register Company, which big deal in those days, was such a harsh boss, he used to communicate to employees that they were no longer required by taking their desks outside and setting fire to them. But fired predates John H. Patterson. It was around in the 1880s, meaning people losing their jobs. Some people suggest that in ancient times, a community would force a person to leave by burning all their stuff. But in reality, an awful lot of language formation was quite practical or banal, whereas these stories are just too much like stories to be plausible etymologically. There isn't a definitive explanation for fired, deal with it, but I think it's quite likely that a person being swiftly discharged from their job is analogous to a cannonball or bullet being fired from a weapon. So, sorry, it's not as good as a desk fire. There might be drawbacks with languages that have been invented, but at least there's not much opportunity there for garbage etymology, because if you ask where the word came from, the person who invented the language just made it up. A few weeks ago, fellow Radiotopian Nate DeMeo from the Memory Palace came on the show to learn the invented language Tokipona with me, and here he explains why he became interested in invented languages.
During my linguistics class, we got this sort of guest lecture from one of our professor's, you know, most beloved and successful students, and he was the guy who created the Klingon language.
Wow.
And I think he might have also gone on to, like, invent Dothraki or, like, Elvish for the Lord of the Rings movies or whatnot.
The same guy. So that's, like, his expertise, just inventing languages for films.
Exactly. But you know, part of what he explained was that he was inventing this language that, yes, did sort of have, you know, certain principles of, you know, the various language groups of the world. But Klingon, in particular, was designed to sound horrible and be very, very challenging to say, because he wanted it to sound like truly alien. He wanted it to come from creatures whose vocal cords, I mean, even though they only look like people in makeup with giant heads, you know, he wanted us to intuit that underneath that semi-similar, you know, exterior was kind of like a crazy interior. And so, like, he wanted things that were sounds that no language would ever put together because they are so difficult to make one after another, or the strain on the voice would be too much, that no people, you know, living anywhere in the world would ever have stumbled upon that through their, like, you know, thousands of years of trade and interaction.
I've been teaching summer school for about 10 years now. I specialize in Klingon language studies. Maj bahasta, Dutch.
Much bahasta, Dutch, Miss Roy.
How much for these apples?
Sabda says, bucolic. I always thought it weird that such a horrible, disease-ridden word could describe something so charming and beautiful as a pastoral idyll. Is it disease-ridden? Are you getting it mixed up with bubonic? It came from the ancient Greek bukolikos, meaning rustic, from the word for herdsman, and that broke down as the bu, which was from the word for ox, and kolos, which meant keeper, and then the suffix ikos. Oxen could be disease-ridden, if you insist on finding a disease connection in the word. Alex wants to know where the word garage or garage comes from. It's from the French verb garer, which meant to shelter or to dock ships. Kelly says, I am a swimming teacher and often sort the children into teams before we play a game. For team names, I like to choose animals from the water. Sharks, dolphins, seahorses. But I get stuck with octopi or octopuses or octopodes. So I may avoid looking like a fool. What is the correct plural, please? Right. Octopus came from the ancient Greek octopus, meaning eight-footed, which is why some argue for the ancient Greek plural octopodes. I think most people would feel like tools saying octopodes, and most people hearing it would be like, what? Do you mean octopi? Octopi is definitely not it. That came from the assumption the word was Latin, so should have a Latin plural. But it's a modern Latin word borrowed from Greek in the 1800s, and even then its plural wouldn't be octopi, so forget octopi! It's an English word now, so let's be practical and apply the standard modern English plural, octopuses. Then we can stop worrying about it and start worrying about the giant squid at the bottom of the swimming pool. Now, Alice Sanders appeared in the Architecting About Dance episode to talk about her work audio describing films and TV shows for people with vision impairments. She mentioned the difficulty of having to put dance scenes into words, but her job is riddled with other linguistic obstacles.
Sometimes we have like our work checked by outside people, like an audio description audit, and they always bring up this thing of homonyms, like words that sound the same but mean completely different things. My colleague was describing, I think it was Michael Palin, one of his like adventure programs. he throws his cock over his shoulder or something. He waves it over the fire. But nobody is going to think it's his penis because we've already had this huge setup about the fact that he has a cockerel. There's not going to be any confusion about that sentence.
But maybe there would be about this sentence.
I remember one in Bridesmaids, she mimes a kind of sexual act. And I think I said something like, she waves her hand like a cock flapping in her face. Something along those lines, anyway.
I don't remember any poultry appearing in that film.
Do you ever try and sneak in bawdy jokes and try and get them past the approvers?
Sometimes I just do put in a little joke. I was once describing an American TV programme called Extreme Dodgeball, although as far as I could tell, there wasn't anything extreme about the dodgeball they were playing. It was just regular dodgeball.
Which does sound quite vicious.
Yeah, true, but the balls weren't on fire and they weren't on a mountaintop, so it was pretty much dodgeball. And then there was this presenter and she was interviewing one of the contestants after a match and she said to him, "So, Dave, you're literally on fire." My description was, no, he isn't. Because I thought that was very misleading to blind people.
I grieve for literally the helpless victim of semantic shift. Carlos says, pithy. Related to pith as in citrus peel, related to a pith helmet. Where's the connection? Although you think the pith is the crappy bits you pick off a clementine before you eat it, since Old English, the word has meant the essential part of something. Mainly plants, but not just plants, because there was also the verb to pith, which meant to kill someone by piercing their spinal cord. When you say something pithily, you're really getting straight to the heart of the matter. And a pith helmet is made from the pith of the Bengal spongewood. Pith, pith, pith. Stuart says, I would love to know where Nimrod comes from, and I would love to make this happen for you, Stuart. Nimrod was the great-grandson of Old Testament starlet Noah. In Hebrew, the name means rebel. Stuart says, how and why is Nimrod an insult? It didn't start that way. It used to mean someone who was great at hunting, because in the book of Genesis, Nimrod is a mighty hunter before the Lord. And he was also the king of Babylon, so it shouldn't be an insult because he was rather mighty, although, like most people in the Old Testament, he was a bit of an arsehole. But scroll forward to Bugs Bunny. He used to insult Elmer Fudd and his hunting skills by calling him Nimrod, so sarcasm eventually flipped the whole meaning of Nimrod. And talking of meanings getting distorted, here's songwriter and singer Tony Hazard, who appeared on the Vocables episode of this show.
I wrote a song once, it was in the late 60s, and I'd had my only acid trip. And in those days, it was terribly strong, so you were out for sort of, you're under the influence for quite a long time. So I wrote this song called The Sound of the Candyman's Trumpet. I'd read somewhere that in the Northeast, in the early part of the century, the sweet seller would go round and blow on a bugle or blow on a trumpet, and all the kids would look a bit like an ice cream van with the chimes.
Only then you know just what it's like to hear the sound.
I use lots of sort of acid-type imagery.
Of the Candyman painting in the sky, colours fly and paints forgotten.
And then for some reason, my publisher put it in for the Eurovision Song Contest. I couldn't believe the MPA, the Publishers Association, had picked it, and that the publisher had put it in, because it was Cliff Richard was singing. It was totally inappropriate. But I did hear it was it was his favourite song of the eight, in fact.
It really makes you wonder whether anyone is interpreting lyrics at all.
Yeah.
Tony's song didn't win that night. It was beaten by Congratulations, which went on to lose the Eurovision Song Contest by just 1 point. Max Klein writes, here's a question of portmanteau romance for you.
Portmanteau! Oh, I hate myself.
When they got married, my girlfriend's parents collided together their two last names to make a new last name they could really call their own. Pugach and Kailar became Aphek. P and F are the same in Hebrew, and they threw in a vowel to make sense. Now, my girlfriend and I would like to do something similar. I thought that her surname Aphek plus my surname Klein could become Afine. From my maths background, I think Afine means family, which would make a great last name. Can you provide a more detailed etymology of Afine or affinity so we can make a more informed decision? Well, affinity came from the Latin for a neighbour. If you break down the word, it's ad finis, meaning to a border, your neighbour being the person who lived on the border of where you live. In 14th century English, affinity meant a person being related to you by marriage. So I think that's a very apt choice for your new marital name.
In contrast, this one goes out to a couple of friends of mine, the etymology of Nemesis. Nemesis was the name of the ancient Greek goddess of retribution and righteous indignation. Her name was from the Greek verb to distribute, because one of her main pastimes was providing balance, particularly for people who were excessively arrogant or fortunate. In Greek myth, you can't be too fortunate or at all fortunate. Amongst many other killjoy achievements, Nemesis was the one responsible for the undoing of the bad-mannered hottie Narcissus. She lured him to the well where he fell in love with his own reflection and spent so much time staring at it he starved to death. Look, I'm sure we've all encountered some self-infatuated people in our time, but that seems excessively mean. That was Nemesis. She was very generous when doling out vengeance, so no wonder the word Nemesis came to mean one's ultimate enemy. Not the note on which I envisaged ending the first year of The Allusionist, because it's been a joy and a privilege to make it and to have you join me, and iTunes UK chose this show as the best new podcast of 2015, which I'm very chuffed about. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is Illiwacker, noun, Australian, informal, a small-time confidence trickster. Several of you have asked whether it's really me ruffling through the dictionary or whether I use sound effects. I wasted all of the show's budget on visual effects like a fool, so the dictionary sound is real. I record it every time using a concise Oxford English dictionary. Okay, I admit one time I wasn't recording the show in my usual place, so I didn't have the dictionary to hand and had to use a copy of Thomas Piketty's Capital, which is almost as big as the dictionary, but just didn't sound right. This is the sound of a bona fide dictionary. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. The show's going to take a few weeks off, and it will be back on the 27th of January 2016. In the meantime, you can catch up on my other podcast, Answer Me This, and you can find me at Allusionist Show on Facebook and Twitter, and at theallusionist.org.